Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is David K. Johnston. He's an investigative reporter with an expertise in economics and tax issues. He was with the New York Times for 13 years and is now a columnist for several outlets, including USA Today. In 2001, he won the Pulitzer Prize for beat reporting on the tax code and tax compliance. He's here with me today because he's also the author of a new book titled The Making of Donald Trump. David, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, your book is titled, as I just said, The Making of Donald Trump. Let's talk about the making of Donald Trump. This is not a book based on just 2 months of research. My understanding is that in a very real sense, you've been working on this book literally for decades. Tell us a bit about that history.
Well, I met Donald Trump in June of 1988 when I went to Atlantic City to cover casino gaming because I expected to see casinos spread across the country. And I almost immediately met Donald Trump because he was the dominant force in Atlantic City. Sized him up immediately as a P.T. Barnum. Buy a ticket to see the Fiji Mermaid and the Incredible Two-Headed Man. And then within days, as I was asking about him, his competitors and some of his own people were telling me he didn't know anything about the casino business, which I found kind of hard to believe. So the first time we sat down to have a cup of coffee, I had a cup of coffee, he didn't. I said something to him deliberately false about the game of craps, and he immediately incorporated that into his answer as if it was true. And I had about 3 backup questions that had falsehoods in them, and he embraced those. And that's when I realized, oh, my goodness, not only does he not know anything, and is he a master salesman, but he effectively operates like psychics on TV or con artists.
And your stories and beat has led you to, I think, have a lot of interactions with him, if I understand. I mean, you've got you drew on quite a bit of files here, right?
Oh, yes. For the years I was in Atlantic City for the Philadelphia Inquirer, I was very focused on him. I wrote a book called Temples of Chance in 1992 about the spread, my expectation of the spread of casino gambling and whether New Jersey had successfully eliminated criminal elements. And almost every chapter of that book has something about Trump. In 1998, the movie director Tim Burton hired me to write a proposal for a movie about Trump. And I very carefully followed his career. And I have what I'm pretty sure is the largest private collection of Trump documents in the world. It's just tens of thousands of pages. And I've read every one of his books.
So one thing you make clear at the outset of your book is that this run for president by Trump is not something that he just thought up in this election cycle, that it's been coming for a while. So tell me a little bit about that, and also what do you think prompted him to pick this election cycle to get more serious about this?
Well, Trump first talked about running for president in 1985. In 1988, he asked George Herbert Walker Bush to make him his running mate, and he lost to Dan Quayle. In 2000, he ran on the Reform Party, which is a little fringe party with tens of thousands of members, and he boasted at the time that he would be the first person to turn a profit running for president because he coordinated some lectures he was giving around the country with his campaign appearances. He had a number of comments about running for president over the next years, and then in 2012, he said that he was running. And he was treated seriously by all of the press except for 2 people, me and Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC. And independently, we both concluded right off that he was running for a new contract for his television show, and indeed, he eventually announced, much as the country needs me, my show needs me more. And that's why when he announced in 2015, everybody treated it as a joke. I was the only national journalist right out of the box to say he's serious this time. And the reason was he was in very serious danger. His show would be canceled. And to Donald Trump, short of death, the worst thing that could happen would be for the New York News, Daily News, and the New York Post, which he reads religiously and has planted news stories in, and they've been fundamental to his creation of the myth of Donald Trump, to run on their covers, NBC to Trump, you're fired. Short of death, that's the worst thing that happened to him. And so I figured that he might get the nomination. If he didn't get it, his problem would be to exit and show he had a larger audience and get a new TV contract. If he did get the nomination, which I said he might do, then the challenge would be, well, he doesn't know anything. How's he going to be president?
I wanted to follow up on something that you touched on there. I was going to ask you about this later, but this is a good time to ask it. There have been a lot of skeptical observers of his around that have claimed he really didn't want to win or wasn't expecting to win, that what he was really doing with this process was to raise his market value. And some folks have speculated, particularly internationally, by getting that kind of attention. So do you think there's anything to that?
No, I don't. One of Donald's sons has talked about how the Trumps are genetically superior to the rest of us. Donald clearly believes in his own mind, from all my years of covering him, there's no question that he is believes he's superior to the rest of us. And of course he should be president. And in a family where all that matters is winning and money, the biggest prize of all is to be elected president of the United States. Now, Trump hasn't done anything to prepare to be president of the United States. He doesn't know what the Constitution says of the duties, powers, and limits on the presidency. But to him, that doesn't matter. Donald has said in 15 minutes he can learn everything you need to know about nuclear missiles. I know more than the generals about ISIS. I alone can solve your problems in America. And the moment I become president, crime will stop. And that goes to a fundamental aspect of Donald. He is a world-class narcissist, and he just makes it up as he goes along.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and the author of the new book, The Making of Donald Trump. Well, biographers of presidents often cite the importance of previous key successes and failures that then shape the way those presidents approach and react to things when they're in office. So, for example, Bill Clinton's early loss of the governor's seat in Arkansas shaped arguably the way he positioned himself as an office holder and a candidate thereafter.
Right.
Do you think Donald Trump would have any defining successes or failures that you would argue would be particularly informative to him if he were to be president?
Yes. Donald has a consistent business pattern his whole life. One with two elements to it. One of them is he never invests a penny. Every deal he does, it's money up front, either in fees or he borrows all the money and takes a fee off the top. So he has a negative investment. He never had a dollar invested in Atlantic City with all three casinos. He had a negative investment. And what he does with these enterprises is he takes cash out of them as fast as he can until they fail. And then he walks away. He blames others. He doesn't assume any responsibility for what was left behind, the carcass, and like a parasite that kills its host. But there's always another deal to make. Now, as president, he won't have the option to do that. That's going to be a real fundamental problem for him as president. The second part of him to understand is that throughout his life, Donald Trump has embraced violent felons, Russian mobsters, American mobsters, con artists, a major cocaine trafficker. They have been elemental to his business. And, well, in New York when he was building Trump Tower, other developers were running to the FBI and saying, will you please rid us of these mafia? Donald Trump embraced these people. And so – if he's president, one of the things we're going to see is a very curious cabinet. It would be fascinating to see what kind of cabinet we get. He's already announced, you know, that he'll get rid of the current generals because he thinks they don't know what they're doing. They've been reduced to rubble. And of course, that's one of the first signs throughout history of a tyrant who intends to take over and end a republic and turn it into a dictatorship.
So that's a pretty strong claim that you just made about some of his associations. So let me give you a couple minutes to give us a few examples of that.
Sure.
To put some flesh on it.
Everything in my book, there's 44 pages of notes in the back, and it all comes from the public record, court cases. But let me give you the biggest, I think most troubling one of all. Donald Trump had to have helicopters. All casinos in Atlantic City had helicopters. Instead of going to one of the well-financed helicopter companies, Donald went to a company owned by a convicted embezzler and mob associate named Joe Wechselbaum. The company got a lot of aid from the state of New Jersey, welfare. It went broke. Donald stuck with it. Went broke again. Donald stuck with it. Joe Wechselbaum, the convicted felon and mob associate, was forced out of the business by the New Jersey Casino Control Commission. He continued to draw a $100,000 salary. This is in the early 1980s, and to have a car available 24 hours a day for his use. Why Trump didn't abandon him and he allowed this guy to manage his personal helicopter, then called the Ivana, is itself curious. But then in October of 1985, Joe Wechselbaum was indicted as a major cocaine trafficker and a major marijuana trafficker. The federal records show that Wechselbaum personally handled the drugs, up to 1,500 pounds, and they were brought from Colombia and sent from Miami to Cincinnati. When Trump is told of this, he doesn't cut his ties to Wechselbaum, even though New Jersey law says that a casino owner must prove by clear and convincing evidence that he is honest and morally fit and doesn't associate with criminals. Wechselbaum then agrees to plead guilty, and he asks that his case be transferred from Cincinnati to either Miami, where the drugs were moved from, or New York City, where he lives. Mysteriously, and I say mysteriously because neither the defense lawyer or the prosecutor can explain this, the case is instead moved to the federal court in Newark, New Jersey, where it comes before Judge Marianne Trump Berry, Donald Trump's older sister. Now, she, after 3 weeks, recuses herself, removes herself from the case. But in doing so, she had to tell the chief judge that she, a federal judge, was regularly flying around in helicopters owned by a major confessed cocaine trafficker. That's got to be pretty scary and disturbing to the judiciary. Trump, meanwhile, wrote a letter pleading for mercy for this man, saying he was a stand-up guy and diligent and he shouldn't get a harsh sentence. When he was asked about this by New Jersey casino regulators the first time, he denied it. Then they went and got the letter and he said, well, that's my signature. And the record we have from that is they never asked a further question. I don't know if they did or not, but their public report ends with he acknowledged he wrote the letter. The mules who drove the drugs from Miami to Cincinnati got up to 20 years. Joe Wechselbaum served 18 months. And the question you have to ask is, what was the relationship between Donald Trump and Joe Wechselbaum, which is much more complicated and much more fully described in my book, that made him need to have him be his friend and not his enemy? Why would Donald Trump risk his unbelievably lucrative casino license on behalf of this cocaine trafficker? And no one is asking that question about what was their relationship and what did Wechselbaum have that could have been terrible for Trump. By the way, to get probation and get out of jail early, get out of prison early, he had to show he had a job. He told his probation officer, his parole officer, that he had a job as soon as he got out with Donald Trump. He also said he couldn't afford to pay the fines the federal government has imposed. But he moved into a multimillion-dollar apartment in Trump Tower.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with David K. Johnston. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who has followed Donald Trump for many years, and he's recently published a book titled The Making of Donald Trump. So I wanted to run one argument that gets made about Donald Trump's rhetoric in particular by you, because you have cited a lot of the more sort of strange or extreme kinds of things that he has said, but you've seems like you've tied them to kind of real things in his life.
Yeah, I don't do gaffes. I do serious, repeated, long form things that he said. I don't care about.
So on that topic, though, a lot of the things that he has said. For example, you said I'm going to get rid of the generals and because they they've been reduced to rubble, or I know more about ISIS than et cetera. Some interpretations of this have been, well, this is a guy that sort of purposely engages in over-the-top hyperbolic rhetoric. And so he's trying to make sort of a different kind of point, and it's resonating with a lot of people, but he's really not literal in this. I get the impression from you, though, that in this guy's head, in your take, he may really think like this.
Oh, Donald, I have no doubt Donald will fire generals or anybody else. He is not a good manager. One of the things that I learned in Atlantic City was that his casinos were very poorly run. Fortune magazine did a study of 496 publicly traded companies, including Donald Trump's casino company. And by every metric, Trump came in either dead last or almost last. I watched him get rid of competent executives and replace them with yes men, and in one case, a drunk yes man. And Trump is someone who does everything by the seat of his pants. He's brilliant at certain things. He's the most masterful manipulator of the conventions of journalism I've ever seen. He's very good at spotting an opportunity to take money for himself through some kind of a deal, how to do that. He's without parallel in that. But he doesn't have any real management skill whatsoever. He surrounds himself with a group of people whose duty is loyalty, loyalty only to him. And that's why I'm concerned about the generals. You know, if we have a professional officer corps whose allegiance is to country. Donald would find those officers who are perfectly willing to be craven and have their allegiance to him. And that's very dangerous for our society.
Has he built anything? You've described several instances now where his strategy is to pull money out of stuff. Are there things that you can say he built this?
Well, he first of all, he hasn't literally built anything.
Right,
he's a developer.
Right.
He had other companies build them. Trump Tower is quite an accomplishment. It'll be there for a couple thousand years in all likelihood because it's made of concrete. It's a 58-story concrete building. And the reason he used concrete was it furthered his profits because of his mob connections. He's built some other buildings or had them built. But the rest of the business enterprises he's had, no, they basically – he sucks money out of them and he's lost huge opportunities. He at one point controlled the West Side Yards, the largest single undeveloped piece of land in New York City. Incredibly valuable property. He could have made billions of dollars. He lost it. And in the book, I tell a little bit about how he lost this. It was the subject of several grand jury investigations that he tried to hide. But Donald basically, there's no long-running business of any kind that he's been successful at other than his television show.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is the investigative reporter David K. Johnston. Many of the things that he's said and that have been said in support of his candidacy have led to controversies over whether he actually harbors racist and sexist
Donald's
beliefs.
Racist. Donald,
you, okay, Donald, you're going to – okay.
No two ways about it. Look, Donald Trump's father discriminated against blacks and Puerto Ricans, and I tell about that in The Making of Donald Trump. Donald has been found repeatedly to have discriminated against blacks, Asians, women, and Puerto Ricans. There have been administrative hearings about this. Donald is not a homophobe. I will say that for him. But – look at his own language. And, you know, when he started his campaign and he talked about the murderers and the rapists from Mexico and his attacks on Muslims, in Midtown Manhattan, a place not exactly known for racism and xenophobia, he kept being applauded with these lines. That was very strange when he made his announcement. Well, a day or two after that, The Hollywood Reporter revealed that they had hired actors for $50 each to applaud, which tells you what a fraud his campaign was. And while he always denies that he discriminates, I'm shocked that he would deny that, we actually have transcripts and hearings and proceedings about this. And his biggest customer, Bob Labuddy in Atlantic City, a gambler, complained bitterly to me when he found out that Donald had removed blacks, women, and Asians from the craps tables where Bob lost about $12 million at Trump casinos. And if Bob Labuddy calls you a racist, that's pretty bad. He's a mobbed up con artist himself, now dead.
Now, you're an expert in tax policy and tax law and also tax cheating, and you've exposed a lot of that in your writing over the years. Among many other things Donald Trump is doing differently from past candidates is he's not releasing his tax returns. So why do you think he's not releasing them and what would people discover, do you think, if
right.
they could see them?
Well, a couple of things here. First of all, we know as a matter of fact from public records that Donald did not pay income taxes in 78, 79, 84, 92, and 94. We know that in the last 3 years in New York State where we've had this star property tax rebate – that Trump got it. Well, a computer picks whether you get it, and it's based on your reporting an income to the tax authorities of less than $500,000. Now, remember, this is a man who has a huge estate in Florida. He has a triplex in Trump Tower. He has two private jets and two helicopters. So one factor is he's paid little or no income tax now for 40 years. Secondly, I show in the making of Donald Trump incredibly strong evidence that he cheated on his taxes in 1984. Sworn testimony by his own tax guy who said when shown his 84 New York City tax return, that's my signature, but I didn't prepare that tax return. And the signature was of a photocopy. No one could ever find the original tax return. Thirdly, so we would find out about Donald Trump's cheating on taxes. Thirdly, there's a special set of rules for full-time real estate professionals that allow them to live tax-free and actually turn a profit off the income tax system. Many of the wealthiest Americans actually profit off the income tax system. They don't literally pay taxes. They may turn over checks to the government, but they're ahead because of it. And that's a scandal I don't think Trump wants to touch. I did write a column in the Daily Beast, the speech that could elect Donald Trump president, and said if he were to give this speech and come clean with the public and say, hey, look, a lot of my fellow wealthy Americans live tax-free and here's how it works, I think – frankly, I think that could take him right to the White House, but I don't think he'll ever give that speech.
We only have just about a minute or so left, but last question I wanted to ask you is one of the other things about his campaign that's mystified political analysts is that he still has not created an integrated and strategic ground organization. What he has in that regard is just simply dwarfed by what Hillary Clinton has. And that seems particularly odd, again, if you're coming into this just on the face of it from someone with a business background and a corporate background. How would you explain that?
Well, because Donald does everything by the seat of his pants. My wife's a CEO. She plans. She thinks. When she got her job, she had a 10-year plan. After 6 years, she'd executed it. So she came up with a new plan. And as a CEO, you spend a lot of time trying to figure out about what you can't do that you want to do. Donald just does whatever he wants to do. This is like the movie Wag the Dog. It's a Potemkin campaign. And by the way, you know, Trump said he was going to fund his own campaign, and then he said he was going to turn the money he put into it up front into a non-forgivable loan. He hasn't done that. And so if he raises enough money from other people, he will make a profit, win or lose, off the campaign. But it shows that Donald has no plan. He just operates by the seat of his pants and will, like any salesman and any con artist, say and do whatever gets him what he wants today and worry about tomorrow. Presidents can't do that.
That was David K. Johnston. And again, his book is titled The Making of Donald Trump. David, thanks much for talking with me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.